This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. I am very, very pleased to welcome our guest, Jason Zeidenberg, who is a researcher with the Justice Policy Institute Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Jason, thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we appreciate it. You've written a number of articles on this subject and have been involved in and done research and commentaries that have appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, USA Today, and so forth and so on. Can we talk first about the Justice Policy Institute Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice to let people know what that's about and perhaps
Sure.
talk a little bit about how you got involved there and
Sure.
then move to the topic of what's going on?
The Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice is a national nonprofit that tries to reduce society's reliance on incarceration as a solution to social problems. We do that through a variety of ways. One of the major way we do it is we provide programs to either adult offenders or children who get caught up in the juvenile justice or adult criminal justice system, try to come up with alternative ways of them to repay society for what they've done, deal with their problems without having them locked up in prison. Most of the organization focuses just on that, delivering services to people in the juvenile justice and the criminal justice system. As the size of the prison system grew in this country, we decided that we also had to do public advocacy work because no one knew that these prisons were springing up left and right and sucking up dollars out of state budgets and the federal budget. So we launched the Justice Policy Institute to basically communicate the message to policymakers, politicians, and the media that you don't need to have 2 million people locked up to have a safe society, and you don't need to treat everyone like they were the worst felon on the face of the earth in order to deal with the issues around the crime. So basically the Justice Policy Institute is is part of the center, and its role is to just communicate a variety of different stories and reports and research about ways of reforming the criminal justice system.
One of the things that you brought up in there, though you didn't use the term, I thought I heard you talking about something that I've read a little bit about, which is restorative justice.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'm not an expert in restorative justice, but basically we believe that there are alternatives to locking people up, and one of them is to have people out of institutions, out working in the community, and if at all possible, working with the victims of crimes to bring about some sort of consensus about why the crime happened. In some cases, restorative justice can mean just doing volunteer work at a drug rehab center. In other cases, it involves, if somebody is involved with the harm of children due to an accident or something like that, it might mean working in a daycare center. So there's various different models of restorative justice, but it's certainly something we'd like to see more of.
The one thing that seems very clear to me is that when we're talking about millions of human beings being incarcerated, there seems to be a better way for society to have a system of justice whereby something positive comes out of it,
right,
or at least as positive as possible can come out of it. And
yeah, the concept of restorative justice is completely out of whack with what we're seeing now, which is a criminal justice system that is entirely punitive. And it really goes against, I think, the goals that most people thought prisons, jails, and police were supposed to do. I don't think most people believe that every crime needs to be punished by a prison sentence, but I think most people do believe that there should be some punishment, but there should also be rehabilitation. And what we've seen in both the adult and juvenile justice system is a complete focus on punishment and a complete disemphasis on rehabilitation. And you can see that through a variety of different things, the cutting off of education programs in both prisons and juvenile justice system, taking away of health care in those systems, and long sentences which don't do much to prepare people for when they will eventually be released.
Jason, let's talk, if we will, about what's happening in the juvenile justice system. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people may be willing to look at adults and have perhaps what we might say less compassion or less mercy for. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about young people, I mean, I would assume that most people would want to see an emphasis on rehabilitation as compared to a condemnation of, well, you know, this kid is 14 and did something really bad, so therefore, you know, lock them up for the rest of their life or worse. What's happening with juvenile justice in our society today?
Well, just about what you were saying before about the balance between rehabilitation and punishment, I think you're right. I think most people do believe that, at least with kids, the emphasis should be on rehabilitation. What's happening with the juvenile justice system, however, is you have politicians, prosecutors, and some aspects of law enforcement that are completely throwing that value of rehabilitation out the window when it comes to dealing with our kids. Basically, first of all, it's important to know, and it's an interesting anniversary this year. This is the 100th anniversary of the juvenile court. It's been 100 years since we as a society have decided that there's a difference between childhood and adulthood and a difference between the way those people should be dealt with in the justice system. What we're seeing here at the anniversary of the 100th anniversary of the juvenile justice system is that more and more states and the federal government are treating children as adults before the court and subjecting children to much tougher sentences, much longer sentences, and also denying them the kind of rehabilitative mechanisms they need to turn their lives around. What I would say is the defining feature of what's happening to the juvenile justice system now. We're seeing a system that's much less geared to giving second chances and directing people towards choosing the right course as we would see a system based on punishment.
I'm sitting here thinking of a couple of things while you're speaking, and one of them is that there seems to be what I think Mike Mayo's, author of The Scapegoat Generation, referred to as this criminalization of youth. I mean, but at the same time, the statistics that I see, I mean, I don't see any increase in, you know, youth crime. I mean, in fact, when you're talking about violent crime, as I understand it, it is usually youth who are the victims and adults are the perpetrators. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, but there seems to be this whole sort of underlying fear-mongering, if you will, that there's this huge wave of, I mean, I've even heard the term, and I think you might have written an article about it, super predators.
Yep. It's the easiest way to dehumanize something is to rename it and reclassify it. Once you start renaming children into super predators, you don't really need to treat them like, you know, children, let alone human beings. And that's what we're seeing our politicians and some other, you know, our politicians, our prosecutors, and some aspects of law enforcement doing now.
We're talking with Jason Zeidenberg of the Justice Policy Institute Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Jason, I guess the question that comes to my mind most pointedly is, if we look at the reality of the situation, or at least as I understand it, I mean, there is not some huge wave of sociopathic young people that are poised on the verge of you know, killing everybody over 30. I mean, we agree on that, right?
Absolutely.
Why is it then that there is this seemingly, or not seemingly, I mean, it's factual pressure to, you know, to further criminalize these young people? I mean, what's the benefit to our society? So I don't understand why a system goes forth like this when it seems on the face of it that the premises are wrong.
Okay, well, there's something important that we need to keep in mind.
Sure.
There is a problem with juvenile crime, and even violent juvenile crime in our country. We have rates of youth homicides, either youth being killed or youth killing, that far exceed the rates in other countries. What needs to be understood about that is that is a highly localized problem, really localized to big cities like L.A., San Francisco, Detroit, New York, and a couple of other cities. Most of those cities account for most of the violent juvenile crime we see in the country. So when people feel uneasy about the issue of juvenile crime, politicians have had something to to bring the cameras to, right?
Right.
This has been happening. The problem is that we're trying to have one-size-fits-all solution that deals with an entire generation of youth, and that's where Mike Mills is correct about the scapegoating of a generation. And the other problem, the way we're dealing with it, is we're not dealing with the root causes of the problem. Now, root causes is often attacked as being, you know, a flighty liberal term for getting at, you know, something through the back door. But anyone, if you look at the juvenile crime rates in the United States, and you compare it to the juvenile crime rates in England or Western Europe, they actually are relatively comparable, except for one criteria, and that is violent juvenile deaths at the hands of guns. Okay? So Americans are correct to feel a little bit nervous about the high number of kids being killed by adults and by kids at the hands of guns in major urban areas. They're not correct to approach the problem by stigmatizing an entire generation of youth and not dealing with some of the root causes of the problem, which are youth poverty and the mass use of guns in our society. So that's where I think we got this image of the super predator. And, you know, like all great lies, it's based on some truth. If we can deal with the real issue at hand, which is getting guns out of the hands of kids and out of the hands of people, you know, not having a gun be the be-all and end-all of our existence, we can probably bring down that problem which we're all nervous about.
Jason, of course, you brought up the issue of guns and root causes, and you know, you're right in the fact that it seems at any time. I mean, here's the way I look at it. If we want to say that we have violent kids, we have to look at, well, who's teaching these kids to be violent and who's providing them with the tools to act this violence out?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that nobody ever wants to look at that. You know, what we want to do is we want to say that, well, there's this huge violent problem in kids, so what we need to do is take all these kids and lock them away somewhere, but we don't want to address the issue of the proliferation of firearms. What did I hear? 200 million guns
right.
Floating around the country. And we don't want to address the fact that we are a country that relies on violence for its primary form of entertainment. And what I'm hearing you say, and we further want to push people into poverty through welfare reform and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to address those issues. That's what I'm hearing you say.
You're hearing me say that correctly. I think none of these issues are going to be solved easily. You know, we now have some draconian welfare laws coming in, and we still have crime, and we had crime when we had slightly more liberal welfare, right?
Right.
Now, the whole issue is that maybe some of the programs we had designed before weren't perfect at getting at the root causes. But that doesn't mean you throw the baby out with the bathwater. The criminal justice community is extremely concerned what's going to happen in the next recession with the kinds of changes we've made to our social safety net and what those effects might have on crime. We're not seeing it now. We may see it in the future. So, you know, I completely agree with that. The other thing is, all the research around prevention programs and all the research that shows what's been good at bringing down crime in select communities where it's been particularly bad, all those programs focus on the root causes. They all deal with the holistic issue of the child. If there's a parenting deficiency, if it's a one-parent family where the parent has to work all the time, if there's a mentor relationship, if there's a community center that's open for the child to access, if there's assistance for the parent, that, you know, that's a community that doesn't go through the same kinds of crimes that a comparable community does. So this isn't rocket science, but they've been able to put us on the defensive with this stuff, as they have on a whole variety of issues. And I think one thing that might help in the future debates over welfare reform and over job creation and rising wages is to reframe some of those debates in terms of the crime control issue.
One of the things that in talking to some of the people that I talk to that repeatedly comes up is that because of welfare reform and the consistent push to dismantle any kind of quote-unquote safety net services and the downward pressure on wages as a result of globalization, that, you know, really this type of, you know, fear-mongering and, you know, ratcheting up of, you know, what some people might refer to as the prison industrial complex is actually conscious in the fact that things are probably, for the vast majority of people in this country, going to get a lot worse in the future, economically. And so the ability and the structure for criminalizing those people and putting in place a structure whereby they can be incarcerated, you know, is to the benefit of people who are planning ahead. Does that make any sense to you?
That does make sense. I think there's an interesting comparison between the prison industrial complex and the military-industrial complex that people analyzed 20, 30 years ago during the Vietnam War, the whole guns and butter issue, and how at some point, with the changes in global economics, we couldn't sustain that. We couldn't spend this amount on the military, this amount on our social programs, without incurring huge deficits, which somehow would have to be dealt with some way, i.e., cutting all the social programs, but not cutting the military budgets. I think the only thing that might work in our favor here in terms of limiting the size and scope of the prison industrial complex is the same issue, that it really costs too much. And if they try to download all of those costs onto working people, there's going to be a rebellion on it. And it'll be interesting to see if that rebellion can be focused at the cause, which is these expensive prisons that aren't solving our social problems.
We're talking with Jason Zeidenberg of the Justice Policy Institute Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, and we're talking about the criminal justice system, in particular focusing on juvenile justice. What do people need to do? The you know, average citizen who's out listening to this program right now, you know, what do they need to do to try and help move this in a direction that may better serve us all as a country and a society?
Well, I'll tell you the first thing you can do is we have an opportunity to defeat a juvenile crime bill, which is winding its way through Congress right now, which would further seek to make the juvenile justice system more like the adult system and further expand the number of slots for juvenile detention, you know, taking away monies from prevention programs and education. I think people need to phone, fax, and write their congresspeople, especially during this congressional recess, and tell them that's not the way they want to go. They want to invest money in prevention programs and in education. They want guns off their street. By sending that message, there's actually a pretty good chance we can defeat that bill. The other thing we have to do is we have to start examining the easiest way we can trip up the prison industrial complex is to focus in on the goofier aspects of it, which a vast majority of people can identify with. Like, for example, in California, three strikes. It's been 5 years since three strikes has been in place. We've seen massive increases in the prison population in California. It's gone from like 100,000 3 years ago to 150,000. That's a huge increase. And this is mostly being driven by the incarceration of nonviolent, low-level offenders who are getting picked up on a third strike. We can start by winning a few victories on those battles. We can build political momentum that might be able to roll the whole thing back over time. So that's my opinion on where we need to go with these kinds of things. The adult criminal justice system has been a dismal failure. Why would we want to make the juvenile justice system, which has had some success, like a system which has failed us?
We've been speaking with Jason Zeidenberg of the Justice Policy Institute Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Jason, if people wanted to get more information about the center, how would they do that?
They can visit our website at www.cjcj.org. We publish all our reports, articles, and commentary up there for free. Or you can get in touch with us in California at 1-415-621-5661 or in the District of Columbia on the East Coast at 202-678-9282.
Could you give that California number one more time?
Certainly, 415-621-5661.
Jason Zeidenberg of the Justice Policy Institute Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, thank you for being with us today, and hopefully we can have you on again in the future. This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments. We are joined by Frank Tamborello, who is with us from Los Angeles, to talk about the Los Angeles Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness. Frank, can you let the listeners know about the LA Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness?
Yes, the Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness is a group that works through education and advocacy to improve public policy relating to, well, basically to people in poverty. And so this can mean educating people as to what's going on with the welfare system and what current policies and practices aren't working and definitely need to be improved. So we do a lot of legislative action and things like that.
Does the LA Coalition publish a manual that actually helps people kind of navigate their way through the social service system?
We do, and it's called, it has two titles. It's known as The People's Guide, but also affectionately called How to Get Food and Money. And there is a version for LA County, and there's also an edition for the state of California.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, and it covers some of the broader information that applies to all of the counties in California for a wide range of programs, including food programs like food stamps and the WIC program, cash assistance programs, including SSI and general assistance, and then all the various Medi-Cal, healthy families, and other health programs that exist these days. And for a broad range of folks, too, Social Security, Medicare, some of the general regulations applying to those are explained as well.
Well, certainly one of the, I think, hardest things for many people to do is to, you know, wade through the bureaucratic morass of these programs. And basically, as I understand it, though I'm sure they won't admit it, one of the pieces of welfare reform legislation that has already been enacted is find a way to deny right off the top.
And it's been, again, like you say, no one will come out and admit it.
Right.
But a lot of people are verbally denied for benefits when they go to welfare offices, and this is absolutely improper and downright illegal. Never, if you need to go apply for assistance, even if you're sure you may not qualify, let them determine that. You have every right to fill out a written application and get a written denial, a written explanation of why you don't qualify for such and such a benefit. There are general descriptions of what it takes to be eligible for each program, the kind of documentation you'll need to show to qualify, and some of the rules that you have to keep up with as you continue receiving assistance. For example, there are monthly reports for most programs, and sometimes people get tripped up by this. They didn't realize they had to send in a report or a they missed it in the mail, and then the next thing they know, they get a notice that their aid is being cut, and they had no idea why.
Frank, can you let our listeners know about the Stop the Clock program?
Right. Stop the Clock is a reference. The clock being referenced is the 5-year time limit on federal assistance for families on welfare, which is now the program now known in California as CalWORKS, and this is for families with children, many of whom are women fleeing domestic violence and others of whom are two-parent families who simply cannot make enough money to make ends meet. And basically what we're saying is put a stop to the 5-year time limits until we get a reasonable assessment of whether the welfare program as it's now constructed is actually helping people get out of poverty. And what studies have been showing is that people are dropping off the welfare rolls, and yet in many cases they're worse off than when they were getting welfare because the jobs they're getting are part-time or not paying enough to make ends meet for the family. Then other families, too, are dropping off of cash assistance and are not aware that they continue to qualify for medical benefits and food stamps. And this is a problem that's going on nationwide. The welfare rolls are indeed dropping, but poverty is not dropping along with it.
As I understand it, the so-called welfare reform legislation, the first waves of the masses amount of people who are going to be pushed out of the system are now, in the next couple of months, really going to begin to start hitting. We're going to see an increase, a very, very major increase, of people who are destitute. And that's what Stop the Clock is trying to prevent on some level.
Exactly. And to make matters more confusing, there's another time limit within the time limit. Families applying for assistance basically have 2 years to get a regular privatized job, you know, a job in the private sector. And if they do not, then they're required to do community service in exchange for welfare benefits. And this has raised some interesting questions. For example, a woman with one child who's getting a grant of $505 a month, yet we'll be doing 128 hours of work per month in exchange for that grant, is not making minimum wage. So some of this is a very questionable practice. Interestingly enough, there was even a woman in New York who lost her job and after some time had to go onto welfare to support herself. And she was assigned to workfare doing the same job that she had done before. Only whereas before she'd been paid a salary with benefits that she could live on, now she was doing the same work in exchange for a welfare check. So in a real sense, it's a return to the days of indentured servitude and outright slavery in some instances.
Can you let our listeners know how they could get more information about the LA Coalition and the Stop the Clock project? And then also, can you let them know, for those people who might be interested, how they could get a copy of the manual that, you know, might be of assistance to them or family or friends?
So they can call the phone number, which is area code 213-746-6511. And I'll repeat that. It's area code 213-746-6511. In addition, there are a couple of sites on the Internet. One of them where you can get all the information that's in the book on public assistance is www.peoplesguide, that's all one word, .org, peoplesguide.org. And there's also a webpage about the Stop the Clock campaign, which is www.stoptheclock.org.
Frank Tamburello of the Los Angeles Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. It's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you this edition of the program today. If you'd like more information about Full Logic Reverse, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by phone, 530-265-9462. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.